We're starting our understanding consolidation piece in our Hope and Understanding series. This is episode 2, where we're going over S. Roan's
understanding consolidation. Hanging on, Curtis. Hopefully Curtis is there. Hello,
hey,
sir.
There we
How are you?
Doing well, thank you. How
Ready
are you?
Ready to take on this second challenge here?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Well, what did you want to mention first? Do you have a set of bullet points that you want to cover?
Well, I think it'd be good to, since we're getting into the second essay of the series,
yeah,
to just give a quick overview that, you know, the first essay, what we covered last time was describing how we have been in a Brave New World type of context for quite a number of years. And then how with this latest transition, I really think kind of maybe through the Trump presidency, things got more and more combative, of course, and the context began to transition into more of a 1984 scenario. And now we're really kind of seeing that full force beginning with force being used, things being done by executive order, things in our culture kind of being told this is the way things are going to go rather than looking like a representative type of government. That kind of set up to where we are.
Okay. I'm not totally, I don't think I agree with everything you just said, but we'll keep going.
Okay. Well, feel free to clarify how you like.
Well, you're right about the dystopian novel stuff, the way to understand the current political moment is by analogy to these dystopian novels that he mentioned, Brave New World and in 1984, specifically the censorship, the thought control, at least the attempts at thought control, which is what censorship is, the doublespeak, just denying that. I agree with what you said there. That when you said executive order, I hesitated there because I don't know if you read what I say on Facebook, but I don't think there's any problem with executive orders at all. I think that's what executives do. They give orders. General Washington, when he became president, that's what he did. And that's fine. But anyway, let's talk about this current essay, Understanding Consolidation. There's a lot to get through. We're not going to get through all of it. I think we're probably going to get through about 5 pages of it out of 13.
Yeah.
So
very like.
Let's start. I'm going to just skip the preface. I don't really like prefaces that much, but sometimes they're helpful. But you could read that. I'm hoping you read it. But he says, when President Trump says he will return power to the people or drain the swamp, what exactly does he mean? These are repeated themes central to his campaign and the trajectory of his presidency. Given the fact that power is dramatically centralized and consolidated in the federal government, if we were to ascertain where that power was originally located by constitutional compact, we must then look to the core founding principle. Then he talks about the crown, you know, taking the disagreement the founders had about the monarchy tradition that they had come from. I'm going to go to which paragraph is this? Well, I have it printed out, and so I'm on essay number 2, Understanding Consolidation, past the preface. So I just read the first paragraph. I'm in the second paragraph now. when the founders separated the apps, separated from the absolutism of the crown, it was to the principle of diffusion of political power. That's an important part there. The diffusion of that's that principle. They turned to in formulating the new regime based on popular sovereignty. And this was to counteract what he calls a natural phenomenon, the end of that paragraph, the propensity to consolidate political power. And then he talks about Randy Barnett in the next paragraph. And the very end of that next paragraph, very last sentence, he says, the real sovereign is the individual citizen.
Yes.
The quote, let me go back up to that quote by Randy Barnett. He says, this is the second sentence of that paragraph, the same paragraph, the founders envisioned. Legal scholar Randy Barnett posits that at the founding, it was a first principle of political theory that sovereignty, or the right to rule, must reside somewhere in any polity. So where does it lie? And with my students, I've asked them, who's in charge of America? Who's sovereign?
Right.
Which institution is sovereign? Just watch them try to struggle through that. What Roan is saying here is that the individual citizen was designed to be sovereign. What do you think about that?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's the people. That's what's uniquely American, is that it's the people who give consent to be governed. And I thought it was interesting too, in this paragraph, same paragraph, he talks about how he briefly touches on how we gave it a first shot in the Articles of Confederation. And when we redid the Articles of Confederation into the Constitution, that we are supposed to be following, that's when they located the sovereignty of the people as individuals. That's when they got it right.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I'll point out something that I noticed. He said that the real citizen is the individual citizen. Sorry, the real sovereign. Did I say said? The real sovereign is the individual citizen. And I noticed you said it differently when you summarized it. You said the people. I don't know if you noticed that, but that's going to be very important as we go through this, that distinction between citizen and people. Do you know where I'm going with this?
Well, I'll let you lay it out.
Oh, okay.
I don't want.
Well, let's just bookmark that.
Okay.
Because I notice he uses the word citizen. And the word citizen means something different than just person. Right?
Right.
Not every person is a citizen.
Correct.
So, for example, in the abortion debate, the unborn might be a person, but not a citizen, recognized as a citizen. That's an example of that. Another example would be in the immigration context. But I mean, really, the way I look at abortion, you could look at it as an immigration issue, because when you're born into that's the word born. When you're born in America, then you become a citizen. That's a sufficient condition of a citizen. But what the Democrats don't see, and this is an ironic part of their position on abortion and immigration, what the Democrats don't see is they think that just because you're not born, that means you're not a person. But the relevant laws about birthright citizenship have nothing to do with denying personhood to the unborn, just that there's a, or actually even citizenship, if you read it carefully. There, it's not necessary to be born to be a citizen. It's just a sufficient condition. Of course, you know, if you taught logic, you know the difference between a sufficient condition and a necessary condition. Being born, in other words, sufficient means it's enough, but it's not needed. Necessary means it's needed, but might not be enough. By analogy, if you're trying to survive on an island, it might be sufficient for your needs of water to have a stream that produces, or a spring that produces 5 gallons a day. That might be sufficient. That doesn't mean you need 5 gallons a day.
Right.
And similarly, if you need water, it doesn't imply that that's sufficient for you to live. You also need other things like air and food and so forth. But in terms of this, in terms of the 14th Amendment, well, we're not going to get to the 14th Amendment yet, but in terms of birthright citizenship, being born is just sufficient. It's not necessary for being a citizen. It's certainly not necessary for being a person. There's no necessary conditions on personhood in the Constitution. So the Democrats are in a real bind there. Of course, that means that they have to have somebody point that out to them, and that's why they don't like professors like me on campus, because I'm a real pain in their ass, and that's why they love censorship. So, do you have anything you want to say about that?
No, I thought you covered the citizenship
Well,
piece there.
yeah, so the person issue, we're going to get back to that because of slavery. That's really because slaves
Right.
were not persons. Or sorry, slaves were not citizens.
Right.
And that's I'm hoping that people are seeing that here. Here it is, Black History Month. So, okay. The next paragraph. These structures were designed to maintain this diffusion, as Madison writes in Federalist 48. He also comments on Federalist 51. And what'd you get out of
Yeah, what I got out of that was that
that?
you know, the separation of powers is really what is intended to preserve and ensure political liberty of individuals. I thought that was he has a quote there from Federalist 51, the power surrendered by the people is first divided between two distinct governments, state and national, and then the portion allotted to each subdivided among distinct and separate departments. Hence, a double security arises to the rights of the people. So they really try to, they really try in here to explain how to layers of protection, if you will, is what the intention is.
Avoiding the consolidation of all powers in the same hands.
Yeah.
Of course, the same thing was going on in England for a long time too. The crown had lost a lot of power to the parliament and to judges. So the same kind of thing was happening, but the difference in America is that we American people, the American people in this design, the people that designed this were purpose, they did it on purpose. They
Right.
thought about it, they deliberated about it, and they said, we're going to start out this way. I mean, well, the Articles of Confederation, you know, was a disaster, but we're going to
Right.
start out. We're going to do something that with separation of powers. Okay. Now, he says, What about the laws of nature? That's something we should probably talk about. So you have 48, Federalist 48, and you have the laws of nature and Declaration of Independence.
I thought that was good, to that part in there where he talks about, because of the laws of nature, let's see, in that second paragraph there on that page, Jefferson identifies in the Declaration of Independence, this ordered system of government will inevitably become increasingly disordered unless the tools provided by the framers are employed to adjust the operation of the system and its component parts in reaction to the ever-changing nature of its surroundings. So, I'm just going to finish it because it's short. Short sentence next. When operating as written, the system was designed to create conditions under which a citizen realized and could sustain his individual state of political liberty. So it really requires the intentional interaction of the citizens.
Yeah.
To be able to have this work. All
sure.
the components need to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And when one of them sits back on their laurels or lets the others take care of stuff, you know, that it's they don't want to be bothered.
Right.
Well, the system breaks down.
Yeah. Yeah. He says there's three.
And it's all, I just wanted to, and so I think what they're really getting at is they're pointing out by all of these layers of protection and making sure that everybody, every component of the system is working together. They're pointing out that just naturally speaking, it's going to be, it's almost natural to just want to consolidate it and make it easy. We always tend to go to the path of least resistance, right? We try to get more efficient. But with that comes, in a government structure, comes more tyranny. It doesn't fit all the parts necessarily. One size doesn't fit all.
Okay. Well, he says there's three major avenues through which this ordered and diffused power, unconstitutionally centralized and consolidated in the federal government. So, first, the open violation of the 10th Amendment.
Yeah.
So we got to look at what that is. Second, through a purposeful evasion of the Constitution's textual and structural separation of powers. Third, through the abandonment of the founding principle of coordinate review, in which each co-equal branch is responsible for interpreting and the meaning of the Constitution within the lawful execution of its own vested powers. And he says, I will focus on four major events that best illustrate the texture of that pavement and how we arrived at the disordered state we find ourselves in the present time. Do you have anything to add there or mention?
Yeah. I mean, there were a couple of things here that were kind of interesting. I'm really curious to see what your take is on the second and the third. The first one where he talks about the violation of the 10th commandment or 10th commandment. Little Freudian slip.
Yeah.
There. Of the 10th amendment, that has everything to do with state rights. And we see that in how the Supreme Court rules and some of the decisions it's made over the years. And he gets into that a little bit. It kind of sent me, going through this part of it, kind of sent me on a little bit of a exploration about nullification. 'Cause here in Texas and in several other states where the Second Amendment is prided and valued, there's a lot of that going on right now. States are trying to put steps in place where they can assert their authority in opposition of federal statutes, where how this one in Texas is going right now, they're in the process of passing. I'm not 100% sure if it's passed yet, but they're at least in the process of passing, that they're not going to give any resources to enforce any Second Amendment laws that come out of the federal government, that they don't, if the state of Texas sees it as unconstitutional, so they won't enforce it. So that's kind of interesting pushback from the state in that particular way. And that mapped onto how, you know, that made me think of all this stuff, which brought me into learning about a little bit more about nullification, the principles of 98, meaning 1978, or I mean 1798, where Jefferson and Madison in their respective states actually wrote about stuff, putting things on the books for nullification. I thought that was kind of interesting. It was always contested, but I found it interesting that Jefferson and Madison kind of championed these things, the state's power over the Fed, or at least making it more of a co-equal type thing where, you know, co-equal is very different than being subordinate to.
Well, why don't we read the 10th Amendment? I just showed,
oh, sure.
I don't know if it is going to show up for people, but I zoomed in on it just a second ago. The 10th Amendment says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So there's the 10th Amendment. I think we should move on here, because
okay.
the very next thing he talks about is related to this. He says, I will focus on four major events that best illustrate the texture of that pavement and how we arrived at the disordered state we find ourselves in at the present time. The first event was the landmark Supreme Court case McCulloch versus Maryland in 1819. Then he gets into the text of the 10th Amendment. He quotes that. And he says, in his opinion, in McCulloch, Chief Justice John Marshall declared and imposed a literal inversion of meaning of this text. Okay, so you get the impression that Roan doesn't like Chief Justice John Marshall.
Yes.
Because he accuses him of literally inverting the meaning of the Constitution by claiming that because the drafters and ratifiers of the Bill of Rights did not include the adverb expressly preceding delegated, that Congress is no longer constrained by the very short list of enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Okay, so I'm going to turn to Article 1, Section 8. What do you think about that? Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, my first thought is that's interesting that Marshall he basically read something into that in order to draw his conclusion rather than sticking with the text. He brought clarification where he felt it was lacking.
Okay.
That's a bit... That's subjective at the least.
Okay. So you're not a fan of Marshall either, apparently?
I wouldn't say I'm not a fan of Marshall. But he may have, you know, no one's perfect.
Okay. Well,
and to be fair, too, I haven't read this decision. I'm only looking at it here in this context. So.
Well, and that's kind of a big deal, I think.
Yeah.
If it's really a first, if this first event is really important, then we probably should really get clear about what McCulloch versus Maryland was. And I'm going to help you do that but we're not going to be, if you haven't read it yet for yourself, then there's no way I can fill that in for you. But I can show you some things that would help you. First of all, I would say just reading the decision for yourself is probably, it's not only within your power, but it would be good for you to get. But there's a nice book that really helped me when I was wrestling through this, and it's called John Marshall's Defense of McCulloch versus Maryland by this guy Gerald Gunther, and it's an older book. It's Stanford University Press, I think 1969 or something like that. And you can see my copy is fairly well marked up here. I got all sorts of patch and stuff like that. And he's got the opinion. Got essays in newspapers that ran at the time for and against the decision. And I don't see that at all, if that's showing up, if it's clear. But my,
yeah, I can see it.
My finger is on somebody's name.
Rones.
And that, the guy that's writing these essays takes his name from him as a pseudonym. Mm. That's the same guy in history who opposed John Marshall in this debate. And what the debate was about, if you have any no idea what it was about, I've got little notes in here. The debate was about whether, let me get to the part there, sorry, was about the bank, famous bank case. So it was about whether Maryland could, whether Maryland could tax a bank, a federally chartered bank. And then the part of the issue was, could the federal government even have a bank? Because that's not in Section 8 of Article 1 to have a bank. It's not listed there. Post offices are listed, making the Army and the Navy's listed, science and technology's listed. Lay and collect taxes, all those things are listed in Article 1, Section 8. Establishing post offices and roads, creating courts, define and punish piracies, to declare war, that's in there, to regulate commerce with foreign nations. But there's nothing in there about a bank. You could borrow money on the credit of the United States. That's in there. So that was the topic, and there was really heated. And one side said, if it's not listed in there, you can't do it. It's enumerated powers, limited government. Marshall said in his opinion that you're missing something in the text of Section 1, Article 1, Section 8, and that's what's called the Necessary and Proper Clause. To make all laws which may be necessary and proper for carrying out into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution and the government of the United States, or any department or officer thereof. So what Marshall said in McCulloch versus Maryland is, when you take the proper, necessary and proper clause in there, you can get the power to make a bank, because it's necessary and proper for laying and collecting taxes and borrowing money and all sorts of stuff that's in there. And so this was a huge dish. This was a huge deal.
Yeah.
But what Roan is saying here, our Roan, modern day Roan, the guy that wrote this, is that this was a travesty. This is a bad thing to say that the government could just do something like that. And it established in the Constitution, he doesn't like these words. He thinks it goes against the 10th Amendment. So the state of Maryland had a total right to tax the bank there. That's what he says. The words legitimate, scope, appropriate, plainly adopted, and spirit share one common trait, he says. All are open to unbridled, subjective interpretation and would be used for the next 200 years to bend and mold Congresses and the courts' interpretation of the Constitution to achieve the consolidationist desired ends. So for him, this is just one more step in consolidating power in the federal government. Now it's got a bank. Prior to this, banks were in the states, but now you have a federal bank. And just like a base, like a base might be in a state, but it doesn't pay any taxes, right? There's
right.
No state taxes on that land. Okay. So what about that? Anything you have to say about that?
No, that's I think that's good perspective. I should read the decision there, and you mentioned is one that looks like it probably give a lot of insight. Gave you insight?
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of John Marshall. I like him. Part of what you do when you study this stuff, well, I can just talk about my own journey, put it that way. John Marshall's defense of McCulloch versus Maryland was just some of the meat and potatoes of what when I did my doctorate. I mean, it was I studied under Michael Uhlman, who was a huge fan of John Marshall, and we read his opinions pretty closely in a number of classes with him, and you figure out who's on what team. Early on, they're all on the same team, right? So you have the Americans versus the British, and you have Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. They're all fighting the same people. But then, once the British are defeated, you have the struggle with the Articles of Confederation and just really quickly getting, this is just not good what we have. So we have the Constitutional Convention, and there's all sorts of fighting that happens there, but it's done fairly civilly. It's heated exchanges, literally heated, because it was in a hot Philadelphia room with the doors and windows shut, so it was they could have absolute secrecy. And then there was, once that was completed, they had to defend that to everybody else in the ratification debates, which is what the Federalist Papers was for. And by the way, I'm going to just plug this version of the Federalist Papers by Charles Kessler. That's probably backwards. But I studied with Charles Kessler. In fact, I took the Federalist Papers from Charles Kessler. And this signet edition is the best-selling edition, a Signet Classic edition. And it's got the Constitution and Articles of Confederation in there. So, but then you have the presidency of George Washington, and that's where the splinters really start coming out early on. Thomas Jefferson is the Secretary of State. Alexander Hamilton is the Secretary of Treasury. James Madison is in the Congress. They start splintering into two different groups. Hamilton is with Washington. Jefferson and Madison get together, and they're on different teams, and they have different debates. By the time Adams comes on, Washington is out of the picture now. Adams, John Adams, it's Adams and the Federalists, which includes Hamilton. It includes John Marshall, because Adams appointed John Marshall to the Supreme Court. John Marshall is a Federalist. Adams is a federal. He's on the same team as George Washington. And then on the other team is Jefferson and Madison. And they start a new political party. And so you have the rise of political parties in American history. Of course, they were there, but they weren't formally organized until this time. And so the two of the three branches of government get taken over by that new political party, Thomas Jefferson in Thomas Jefferson's presidency. And you have Madison and you have Roan. He's on their team. Roan is a state judge in Virginia, I believe. I think he's a Virginia Supreme Court judge, I think. Anyway, so there's these debates that happen, and you have Marshall, who's got a life position in the Supreme Court. He's there for 34 years throughout this. And so it's the Supreme Court that is standing against the Democratic Republicans, which is what they called themselves. Sometimes the short is Republicans. But I don't want to say Republican, because that's not the modern Republican Party. The modern Republican Party was started in 1854. This one was started before the 1800 election. So it's called the Democratic Republican Party. And so anyway, that's a long history there, but kind of necessary to see that there were some fractures in the founding fathers. They didn't all believe the same things, but it took life experience to bring out these disagreements. And they were disagreeing about stuff that was like pretty basic, like could there be a bank that was chartered by the federal government? Everybody agreed that states could have banks. Everybody agreed about that. But the federal government, they were really worried about the federal government just doing something new and using the necessary and proper clause, and then now we're doing something new, and this is what. And so what Roan is saying here is he's going to fast forward. He's going to say there's a lot of crap that happens later that ultimately can be traced back to saying government can do whatever necessary and proper, you know. I mean, fast forward and you have Nancy Pelosi saying necessary and proper clause for the Affordable Care Act.
Right. You know,
or the impeachment.
Well, no. The Congress, that's enumerated. The Congress can impeach the president. They don't use the necessary and proper clause for that. They would use it for anything that's not in there. It's not in the text. So, for example, they would use it to create the Air Force. Because there's no Air Force mentioned in the Constitution. But we have a Department of Air Force. It's not the same. It used to be under the Army. But it's now its own department. And, of course, now we have the Space Force. That's definitely not in there, right? So, this is really about the question of the necessary and proper clause. Is that a faithful use of that? the founding. And you have people split along those lines, even today. Hope that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot about the necessary and proper clause that seems to be able to justify almost anything.
Yeah.
It really brought things, that's for sure.
Well, what Roan is saying is that this is just a violation of the 10th Amendment. What Marshall is saying is that there's a good quote in this Gunther book. I'll show that Gunther book again. You might need to get a mirror to look at this, but but it's let's see if I can find that quote really quick. The way he said it was that the should have just sound like you're on a military base. It's bringing back memories. Every time I was on LMU, teaching at LMU, the LAX is right near there. And so I would be walking around LMU and hear those planes, and I would always have flashbacks to being in the military, as I flew a lot in the military. Okay. Well, I'm having a hard time finding the specific. I really should have marked it, because I have everything else marked, but it had to do with limiting the necessary and proper clause to understanding it as a reasonable convenience. That's what that means. It's not extreme in the sense that it empowers the government to do whatever the hell it wants to do. But it does empower the government to do what is reasonably convenient in carrying out the other powers that it has. The word necessary, I mean, what's the word necessary mean? Is it necessary to have a bank? Well, the people like Roan back then would say, And Jefferson originally and Madison, although they ended up changing their minds on this, but they said, no, it's not necessary to have a bank, because there's already banks. There's a state bank. You can use that bank. It's not necessary to create a federal bank. So you're abusing that term. And Marshall is saying, well, it's not a strict necessity. It's necessary and proper, meaning it just has to be reasonably convenient. So necessary means reasonably convenient. And it's not convenient to pay taxes to Maryland. That's a waste of taxpayer money.
Right.
So, I mean, and it wasn't a small sum either. It was... Well, I don't really know how much it was in those. It was a $15,000 tax bill. That was the. Let's see here. Yeah, it was a $15,000 tax bill that gave rise to the suit. So, I mean, how much is that in today's dollars? I don't know. But it was. That was just one bank.
Certainly a considerable sum.
Well, I think that. I believe that George Washington had a salary of $25,000 as the first president, I want to say. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't know how much that sum is. Like, is it most of what the president would make? But the obviously the question is, you know, It's not a, it's not tiny. It's not a tiny amount, but it is something. So anyway, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, if the president's paid a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, this, you know, this time of year or this time of in history,
400,
it's look. Oh, is it, did it go up to 400?
Yeah. A while ago.
Oh, oh, did Obama do that? Sorry. I remember
he didn't do it. Congress did it.
I remember under Bush, it went up to 200. I didn't realize it was
200 for a long time. Yeah. It was 200 for a long time. Like 40 years or something like that. It was a crazy long time.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. Under Reagan, I think it was 200. Clinton, I believe. I think it went, I don't know when it went up. It would be between Bush and Obama. So, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, that covers the the event.
The second event was the ratification of the 14th Amendment. And I think we might want to stop there. I was hoping to get to that, but I spent too much time on McCulloch versus Maryland. But the 14th Amendment, we'll have to talk about that.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And he gives the Southerners' view of McCulloch versus Maryland. That's not exactly fair, though, because John Marshall was from Virginia. He was a Southerner. And so was George Washington. Mm. So, well, put it this way, the Confederates would like this so far. They would like it so far. And when you talk about the 14th Amendment, that was purely Republican. That was a Republican thing. The new Republican Party. So we probably should get to that as next time. So we'll stop there and sign off. And do you have anything else you want to say? Let me see if I can see any comments or questions. Not sure if anybody did the reading.
Yeah.
I don't see any questions.
The only thing I want to add that I'd want to add is just that there's a lot in here. And if people are getting through this, it's very instructive. Very instructive.
Yeah. Amy says, and who are the Democratic Republicans again? Amy, that was the first political party that formed in opposition to the government at the time. It was Thomas Jefferson was at the head of it, and Madison. So they started, yeah. And they were in opposition to John Adams and, by extension, George Washington. And, of course, this guy, John Marshall, that we were just talking about. John Marshall. I'm a big John Marshall fan. I like all these guys, but it's instructive. There was a lot of fighting back then. And
yeah.
If you're discouraged about polarization now, I mean, you have no idea. But look at this in this context. In the history of the world, the first time there was ever peaceful transition from one political party to another was in the year 1800 in the United States. In the history of the world, first time. So that's why all these pearl clutchers, you know, with this thing that happened last month, you know, at the Capitol, give me a freaking break. Give me a freaking break. A little perspective. A little, a little perspective. You can, hey, you could, you know, you got that axe and you're just grinding that axe and it's going to be a nub pretty soon and you're not going to have anything else left because you're, you know, it's just so, you're just so already so, we're so over it, you know, the histrionics. Yeah. Jeez.
They're kind of already.
I really wish that there were that many troops guarding businesses last year from being burned to the ground.
Right. Right.
Protecting individual lives. Why are you only protecting the government? Still... Why do you only protect the government? Protect people. You're supposed to be protecting people.
Those riots are still going on.
So the hypocrisy, I don't like it at all. I don't like it. Yeah. We're supposed to defund the police and be Black Lives Matter is against the police, but the military is okay and barbed wire. It makes no sense. Makes no sense at all. Not to mention all those black businesses, those black people. I mean, I shared something, I think it was in the summer. It was a video I did. Might have been on my public page. It probably was on my public page that I did this video of the Secret Los Angeles story is a site that I look at. It's called Secret Los Angeles. And they did this interview of this black business owner who was thanking the protesters for not burning his business down. Meanwhile, other businesses got burned down, but he was thanking, you know, thank you. And it was all about black businesses and how great it is. But they just happened to not burn his business down. I mean, you know, and what about other people? It was, I hate it. I just, it's up there.
Yeah.
That video is up there. You want to take a look at it. Because I have the video. I did a Facebook Live and I got that video on there. And it's so, there was nobody protecting those businesses. He was just thanking the rioters for. So I just, you know, that goes back to whataboutism that me and Adam did. But anyway.
Yeah. That's the kind of stuff you feel like an American, right?
Well, I got to get going. And
all right.
Good hanging out with you.
Yep. Good talking about this stuff. We'll do more.
All right, buddy.
All right. See you
later. Okay. Bye.